So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your Monday is starting well. Coming up next hour, Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent Austin Buettner. And he is asking that all district personnel be vaccinated before schools come back to campuses. And United Teachers Los Angeles, the union that represents LA teachers, says it wants to go beyond just universal vaccination of all teachers and staff members before classes on campus resume. So we'll talk about that with him next hour. But first, we have big news out of Sacramento, where California's Department of Public Health has pulled back the stay-at-home order that was issued statewide a few weeks ago. This now allows counties, depending on where they are in the color-coded tiers, to determine the extent to which they want to have businesses opened. They could potentially have outdoor dining, for example. Hair salons, barbershops could potentially reopen, nail salons. The question is, what are the counties or the cities with their own health departments going to choose to do? With us from Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, a very good Monday morning to you. What do you think about the state pulling back on this?
Well, it's daunting and a little bit scary. I think you have to remember that we are concerned about some of the variant issues that might be circulating now, viruses that have mutated a little bit and changed their ability to infect other people. So that risk is perhaps higher when you open things up than it was, let's say, back during the summer or certainly back in March or April of last year. So from a virologic standpoint, there is a higher risk. That being said, we are rolling the vaccine out, and we certainly, unfortunately, have many, many people who have acquired COVID and so have some natural immunity. So that is also occurring in the background with this. And, of course, there's the economic pressures. I mean, there's no question this pandemic is having devastating effects on the economy. So all of those have to be balanced together, I think, in addition to our ability to have other mandates such as mandatory mask wearing, again, practicing very good social distancing and so forth. And so I think we know how to protect people from this virus. It's whether they will participate in their own protection. That's really always the overriding question. Restaurants want to try to get as many people in as possible, and although it's outdoor dining, sometimes they are crammed into kind of some smaller spaces where viral transmission can occur. So those are all the things that have to be carefully weighed on the background of what the epidemiologists say the percent positive rate is in each of those counties.
Well, I was just wondering, with the limited ICU capacity in Los Angeles County hospitals, I don't know if it's similar for Orange or the Inland Empire, but I wonder if the health departments are going to be very wary of this. And in fact, to put you on the spot a bit, because I know you consult with Pasadena's director of public health, if she asked for your recommendation, what would it be as to whether you think Pasadena should reopen outdoor dining and salons?
Well, that really is a discussion that's in the purview of the epidemiologists, and I'm a clinician. You know, certainly speaking from what the hospital just went through, it was pretty horrendous. I do think we are sort of over the crest of the wave for right now, but we're still dealing with a tremendous amount of death and disease. And so my perspective is very different than perhaps the public's perspective on things. So I do think that these decisions are made very carefully. They're very complicated decisions, and they're very difficult decisions because it's the balance of keeping our economy and society going versus controlling the virus. And we are just beginning to develop the right tools for this. We certainly know how to protect ourselves with masks and social distancing, but the rollout of the vaccine is going to be critically important. The faster we get people vaccinated, the more people we get vaccinated, the faster we can return to some type of normalcy.
We have some good news from Moderna, where at least in the laboratory, they were able to show, according to their account, that their vaccine is effective against the variants, particularly the UK one, where it showed a strong immunoresponse. It was somewhat impaired against the South African strain, but still they believe it would be effective against that. And Moderna said it's developing a booster shot that would be targeted at the South Africa strain. So, again, I know this is in the laboratory, but do you take this as a very solid positive?
Well, I think it's very good that they're looking at this. First of all, I applaud, you know, the scientists that continue to monitor the emergence of strains. This is a normal thing for coronaviruses to do. We've been a little lax in the United States about monitoring the genetic transformations of these viruses, and so I think there are startup companies now and certainly the CDC surveillance system that are really trying to keep a close eye on what's emerging, because this is going to be an ongoing process. I also think that this is where the mRNA vaccine platform is very handy. It's pretty easy to dial in a different recipe, if you will, or adjust it a little bit to accommodate some of these variants. And you're absolutely right, Larry. The current studies seem to show a good antibody response to certainly the B117 that's in the UK and probably circulating here. The South Africa variant's a little less robust response, but probably good enough. We have some of our own homegrown problems here that hopefully will be evaluated as well in terms of resistance to the vaccine. But I think that that's the flexibility of this type of vaccine is a very promising thing.
And when you say homegrown problems, what are you speaking of there?
Excuse me. Well, you may have seen that there's a little bit of an emergence of something called the L452R, which is a newer one that's been circulating up in Santa Clara County and some here in L.A. It was recognized over at Cedars. In their genomic sequencing. And so that, again, is of concern. This is a normal thing for these viruses to do. The vaccine pressure, the pressure of the vaccine itself may cause the virus to want to try to mutate into something that can overcome the vaccine. That's just a natural selection sort of deal that happens in these situations. These viruses replicate very quickly. They make a lot of mistakes. And every once in a while, they stumble upon one that's effective in overcoming either therapies, of which we don't have very many, or vaccines. So this can happen anywhere, especially where there's a high density of disease, and we certainly have had that here in Southern California, so we've got to keep an eye on it.
We're taking your questions for infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, a part of our KPECC family, as she's been with us weekly, in some cases more often, from Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, taking your questions on COVID-19 and the coronavirus vaccination process. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, AirTalk page, kpecc.org, or you can tweet at AirTalk as LA Real Estate Art tweets, "Do we know why some people are asymptomatic? Is it that their immune systems are stronger? And does asymptomatic infection also happen with other coronaviruses or with the common flu?"
Yes, it does. Asymptomatic infection can happen really with any virus. It even actually happens with HIV to a certain extent, although that's sort of a different story. But so that's not that rare. Why it is in this for this particular virus, we don't quite know yet. There does seem to be a pattern that asymptomatic carriers tend to be younger. There's not any ethnicity preference that we can see or any other factor, but there may be some genetic factors that guide this. And so we're not entirely sure why that occurs. It probably has something to do with the amount of virus that's expressed in their nasopharynx, but their immune system sort of has the ability to keep it under control. It's possible that other coronaviral infections that these individuals have had in their life may protect them from having some of the more deleterious effects with this particular virus. We really don't know. There's so much about this virus we don't know. And we're you know, a year into this, but that's a very short period of time when you're studying a brand new pathogen.
Well, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Schreiner, but I thought a few months ago we were talking about that at that point some of the early evidence indicated that there may be a dose effect, so to speak, that the more of the virus you're exposed to, that potentially increases your odds of contracting or having a more serious case of COVID-19. Is that held up?
That seems to be holding up. You're absolutely right, Larry. There's something sort of the viral load, the inoculum, if you will, of the virus. It's the inoculum and the duration of time that you're exposed to it that probably dictate whether you're going to become infected. Whether you get sick with it or not is a whole different ballgame sometimes. And we do think that people with higher viral loads, there are some data to support this, often mostly are sicker. But it's complicated because it's a two-part thing. There's the virus viral load, and then there's the extent of ACE2 receptors, which is the primary binding site for the virus. And so that may be a factor in terms of why some people can walk around with a lot of virus in their nose and be asymptomatic carriers and not get sick. But we don't know for sure. It's a very complicated dance that this virus does with the immune system. And remember, it's the immune system's reaction that creates the disease. It's this really robust inflammatory event that happens with infection.
Our immune system turning against us, so to speak.
Exactly.
Dixie in Palm Springs wants to know, how long are asymptomatic carriers shedding the virus, essentially spreading it into the environment?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know for sure. There have been a few little studies that have looked at this, and usual situations where immunocompromised individuals have had sort of very long-term infections and, of course, are still infectious because they never really were able to clear the virus out of their system. But I think for the general public, most people are infected with the virus for about 10 days to 14 days. We think that may be true for asymptomatic carriers. We don't see evidence at this point, or at least it's not very common, that individuals are asymptomatic spreaders for long, long periods of time. But that data really is not very well known at this point. So we have to assume that it's somewhere between 10 and 14 days, like all other viral infections. But it's not clear.
Esther in the Pico Robertson area says once you're vaccinated with both shots and then you've had the period afterwards for it to become fully effective, can you visit family in another state? Can you get together with other people who are not vaccinated?
So this is the question. I think it's very important that I'm pleased with the amount of enthusiasm over the vaccine. That's encouraging. But we have to remind people that this does not provide you with the free get out of jail card, so to speak. It's important that you, especially when you're around unvaccinated people, that you continue to wear a mask and protect them, because you could shed the virus. You can still carry the virus around in your nasopharynx and potentially infect non-immune individuals. With regard to being around other people who've been vaccinated, yes, that may be safer. But again, this is all new territory. So I think for the next year or so, it's prudent when you're in a gathering, when you can wear a mask, if everybody's vaccinated, at least you should try to continue to practice a little bit of social distancing, a little bit of mask wearing, just to kind of keep the flow of virus down. It may well be that people that are vaccinated are less sufficient or less efficient carriers of the virus. That data was in some of the animal data, but we don't have much in the way of human data right now on that. But I think that may be coming. Pfizer's been looking at that, and it does appear that you can kind of decrease the carriage rate in people who've been vaccinated. But we still have to be very careful going forward.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist with us. We'll take more of your questions for her as we continue on Air Talk. Just a reminder, next hour, Austin Buettner, the superintendent of the LA Unified School District. We have an extended interview with him next hour and many, many questions for him. Stay tuned. That's coming up here on Air Talk, but more with Dr. Schreiner in just 90 seconds. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. So many Southern Californians, tremendous frustration over trying to get vaccinated against the coronavirus. Those 65 and older who haven't been able to get in to make appointments, or what seems to be confusion about when they'll be called back for the second dosage of the vaccine. Doing our best to get you the information, but frankly, this has been so chaotic. It's difficult to even find the person who has a sense of what's going on. And this kind of epitomized JSK writing on the Air Talk page says, I asked my health department if there was a comprehensive written plan in place that was driving vaccine distribution decisions. Should citizens expect that? JSK asks. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital, it doesn't seem that there is such a document. At least I'm not aware of it.
Well, I think that the Biden administration is in the process of trying to get things back, all the ducks in a row again. I think the ducks were loose on the pond here for a while, so it was kind of everybody just sort of did whatever they needed to do. Remember that under the previous administration, the governors were put in charge of running each thing according to their states, which, you know, in and of itself isn't a terrible thing to do. The governors often know their state's needs better than the federal government. But during a pandemic, a universal vaccination program has to be under the auspices of the federal government for exactly this reason, because it can be disorganized and confusing for the general public. You don't want to frighten people or frustrate people when getting the vaccine is so very important. I think it's working itself out, Larry. It's still disorganized, but I think a lot of people now are beginning to kind of get in the groove here a little bit. You know, you have a whole portion of the population that doesn't have access to social media or isn't very good at doing social media. And so that's a problem if that's the main platform for the information. So you have to make phone calls and so forth. And remember that we had to get through the first tier of the healthcare workers and the nursing home residents and so forth. So the general public part's going to be messier. But I think by the next couple of months, most people will have access to a vaccine.
Yeah, and I certainly hear what you're saying about the federal government, and I, you know, that's a very fair criticism. We're learning more about the lack of attention at the federal level to COVID-19. But here in California, we've had a high percentage of the vaccine that hasn't quickly gotten into people's arms. And that's, according to the governor's office, doses that the state had on hand that were within the borders of California, but not being distributed. And I mean, is that not fair to say a state and local failure?
Well, I think I don't like to say it's a failure because I think this is just something we've never had to do this before. You know, they didn't have a vaccine during the 1918 pandemic, so everybody just got the disease and died or recovered. And so this is the first time we're doing this. And, you know, it isn't just the United States. It's going to have to be the whole world. And every single country, even countries that have very robust centralized healthcare systems, are struggling with this, in part because the vaccines are coming out sort of sporadically. They're having to crank up the number amount of production. Some of the vaccines, like Pfizer, some of that comes from Europe. And so there's a lot of cogs in the wheel here where things can go awry. I'm actually impressed that it's as good as it is because it could have been a lot worse. And I think that we just have to kind of find the rhythm here and get the public on board, and everybody has to be patient. But I am pleased about the enthusiasm for the vaccine because I was very worried there might be a lot of fear, and there probably still is some, but this is our only way out of this thing. So I think it's really important that we do it.
All right. Linda, in Pasadena, you're on Air Talk with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital.
Hi, Dr. Schreiner. My comment and question is, I run several residential facilities in Pasadena for elderly people. We have been fortunate enough to all receive the Moderna vaccine. And fortunately, two staff members have tested positive just this week. So approximately 2 weeks after receiving the vaccine, now they're positive. My question for you is, how long do they need to wait to receive the second dose for it to be effective?
And it's the Moderna vaccine they received?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Schreiner?
Yeah, they're between doses of their Moderna vaccine.
It's what it sounded like, yeah.
Yeah, so we've had some instances like that as well. It's, you know, the Moderna vaccine is a 4-week vaccine, so that probably is still safe enough if the infection was within a week. Generally, what we are recommending for people who are recovering from COVID is that they wait 90 days after their last symptoms. Whether they should get the second shot or not is not clear. They might do just fine without the second shot because they actually got natural infection, so that was sort of a booster, although I suspect that those individuals probably were positive before they got their shot. So, you know, these kind of events are happening, and it is possible that, you know, when they got their first shot, they didn't have enough immunity to protect them from the disease. But we also know that 5% of people do still get COVID if they've been vaccinated, fully vaccinated. So it's not a perfect vaccine, but it's pretty darn good. So I would say at this point, probably the best thing to do would be to wait the 90 days and then offer the next, just the second vaccine. Or you could also do an antibody measure and just see what they look like. And if it looks like they've got enough immunity, then just forego that second vaccine.
All right. Linda, thanks. 866-893-KPECC. Dr. Schreiner, we've had a number of questions about how long someone can go delaying the second shot of the vaccine without that potentially losing the effectiveness that the combined two shots provide. I understand, of course, that during the interim period between shots, they'll have less protection. But we're talking about whether the overall post-second vaccination protection would in some respects be lost if there's a long delay.
Well, that's a great question, and I think we don't quite know the answer to that. It may well be. We know that after, just before you get your second shot, this is both the Pfizer and the Moderna data, that you probably have about 75, maybe 80% of your antibodies at that point. That second boost just kind of gets you up into the 90s and higher. We think that there's probably quite a bit of immunity just after the first vaccine. That's been a big discussion. How do we, if we have a huge vaccine shortage, is it better just to give everybody one shot and hope that that's enough? Should we split the dose, decrease the second shot maybe to 50%? There are some people who suggest doing that. So that second boost in dose is exactly that. It's to kind of jog the memory of your immune system and say, okay, you have to pay attention here because this nasty virus is circulating and here it comes, and so you want to respond in a very aggressive fashion. But we may find out that maybe one vaccine is enough, or sort of one with a delayed, even, you know, longer than the 4 weeks might be adequate just to kind of jog the memory of the immune system. And I think that first vaccine is critical. If there's a long period of time where somebody misses their second dose and it just isn't feasible, then, again, you can measure antibodies or you can go ahead and just give the second vaccine. We don't really know. There's not a lot of good science on that right now, but it probably wouldn't hurt you, and it may jog the memory a little bit.
We've got some news coming out of locations throughout California following earlier this morning the state withdrawing its stay-at-home order. By the way, the curfew between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. also has been removed. London Breed, the mayor of San Francisco, said in a tweet, "We will be moving forward with some limited reopenings, including outdoor dining and personal services." Orange County, according to its public health agency, says it plans to lift some restrictions as well. And then in Los Angeles County, Supervisor Catherine Barger is supporting reopening outdoor dining, personal care services, and other industries. Said the state must balance public health with devastating social, emotional, and economic impacts of this virus. Later today, LA County public health officials will hold a media briefing. We should learn more about whether LA County is going to reopen outdoor dining and salons and the like. But it sounds like Orange County is going to move in that direction pretty rapidly, and San Francisco doing the same. We'll continue with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital. We'll be back with more of her thoughts on COVID-19 in just 1 minute. Julie in the Valley writes on the AirTalk page, "I think reopening now is insane. I know nobody asked my opinion, but there it is." Julie, your opinion is always solicited on AirTalk, along with every other listener's. That's why we call it the biggest conversation in Southern California. Nowhere else in radio do you bring together this size of an audience to hear the voices of listeners or the comments like Julie's about what's going on. You can share your questions right now at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What's the latest on other vaccines in the pipeline? I know Merck, the big pharmaceutical company, said its two vaccines under trial were duds. Too weak of an immune response, they're being dropped. But what about Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, which has been in use now for weeks in the UK?
Yeah, the Merck problem was disappointing. They have quite a bit of experience. The happy news is that Merck is one of the few pharmaceutical companies, big pharmaceutical companies, that's helping to develop an antiviral for coronavirus, which we absolutely desperately need. I have long tried to, we utilize the platform we have for HIV, where we don't have a vaccine, but we have excellent medications, and we really need to have more good antivirals that make a huge difference. That would make an enormous difference in the people who have the disease and probably help diminish the spread. So I applaud them for pursuing that, but their vaccine trials were disappointing. Sanofi Pasteur, which is an enormous vaccine company, they also had some disappointments. So the AstraZeneca vaccine sort of distribution and so forth, their studies were a little bit hampered. They had a couple of mistakes. They did pause the vaccine trial for a little bit. It appears to be a very safe and immunogenic vaccine, but it is a two-part shot as well, so that makes it a little bit more cumbersome. And they've had an awful lot of trouble with rollout in terms of supply and so forth, mostly in Europe. Over here, Johnson & Johnson. My understanding is they're looking at the data right now, and that they're going to release some of that information in the next couple of weeks and apply for emergency use authorization. But I don't know all the particulars about that right now. That's not been released yet.
Ellen in Pacific Palisades said, I had the first round of the Moderna vaccine. A week later, I developed an itchy rash at the site of vaccination. I can't find out whether it's safe for me to get the second dose. Ellen says she's nervous about that.
I would think it's safe. All kinds of little peculiar reactions can happen. Sometimes that's the itchy rash at the injection site, maybe more just a little local inflammation that's happening. I had kind of a sore arm both times when I had my vaccines, maybe a little itchiness as the soreness went away. But the vaccines are very, very safe. Both of the Moderna and Pfizer trials released their data, and for Moderna, well, there was only 2.5 cases, severe cases of a reaction, or I'm sorry, a severe reaction, 2.5 cases for every million people who received the dose. And in Pfizer, it was 11 cases. So those are very small numbers. And indeed, even in anaphylaxis, which is the most worrisome reaction, really only about 10 severe cases have been reported. Thankfully, nobody has died from it. So the vaccines appear to be very, very safe. So I would encourage her to get her second vaccine. She might want to take a little Benadryl before if she's worried about the itch or after, but the protection of the vaccine is very good.
Harold in West Los Angeles asks, are we going to see another year of social distancing and mask wearing? If so, what benefit will that have after most people have been vaccinated?
Well, I think we are going to see several months of that for sure. And remember that, you know, you have to get the whole planet vaccinated. You can't have smaller countries that don't have access to vaccines have continued outbreaks of coronavirus. That just drives the pandemic. And remember, this virus can mutate, and we can sort of have a new beast circulating it all the time. So there's a real emphasis on trying to get the vaccine out as fast as possible, get as many people around the world as vaccinated as possible. And that has to be used in tandem with ongoing social distancing, mask wearing, perhaps therapeutics if we have a push for that, and just good general public health. So yes, unfortunately, our behaviors are going to have to be modified for several months, perhaps a couple of years, you know, and I think that there's some behaviors that could be modified in perpetuity. I think wearing a mask on an airplane is not a bad idea. It's, I used to always get an upper respiratory infection when I would fly, so I will never get on an airplane now without a mask on. So I think that there's a lot of lessons learned from this. But we will eventually get to a point where the virus is under control and we can move on.
Why would we still need to distance and mask once everybody who wants a vaccine has had it and completed the whole number of necessary shots and time afterward? Once we've reached that point, and there's still going to be some people who might choose not to be vaccinated or for whatever reason aren't vaccinated, why at that point would it not be safe for us to go back to normal?
Well, I think there's some triggers that we could look for, Larry, in that situation. And the most big one would be really almost the complete disappearance of any outbreaks. And we have seen that with viruses. We certainly have seen it with all the pandemic. And that's an important thing to observe, that once you have achieved herd immunity and there really isn't a place for the virus to go, then the number of outbreaks that you have, they might be in isolated areas of non-immune populations, but they really begin to fall away. And so that's a very important factor in deciding when we can actually just kind of loosen things up. You know, lots of people wore masks into the 1920s because of what happened during the 1918 pandemic. And so it's something that carries over, I think, until we see the disappearance of this virus. And it could disappear pretty quickly. The first SARS actually did disappear quite quickly. So once we get it under control, I think that, you know, hopefully the amount of time we have to continue doing really kind of difficult mitigation with mask wearing and social distancing, that'll fall away.
Miriam in La Crescenta, in La Cañada asks, nowhere in the tiers does it say when people under the age of 65 who have underlying conditions are supposed to get the vaccine. Do we have any idea yet?
Well, I believe it's in Tier 1B that immunocompromised people, and that would be sort of underlying conditions, and that can include things like diabetes, obesity, hypertension, cardiac and pulmonary disease. Those individuals, you know, they should be thinking about trying to get a vaccine now. If you have if you're a cancer patient or you have HIV or you have you're on immunosuppressive therapy, then you probably qualify for getting a vaccine now. And we encourage those individuals to get vaccinated because this disease is devastating in that population. People that are on dialysis, very, very high mortality in that group when they get COVID. So we're trying to get into the dialysis centers and get those patients vaccinated. So it should be happening right about now. Tier 1B was immunocompromised folks, and that would include people with maybe lesser things like diabetes and so forth.
Jay in La Crescenta says, my wife is a nurse at Huntington. She cried when she saw the news about the reopening. The level that the hospitals are being overwhelmed, it's unconscionable to lift the stay at home. I just hope people understand how bad it is right now. That's Jay in La Crescenta talking about his wife. Colleague, obviously, of Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Dr. Schreiner, thank you so much for being with us again.
It's always a pleasure, Larry.
I appreciate it. Stay tuned. Coming up, we have much more in the second hour. I'll tell you about it momentarily, including Austin Buettner, the superintendent of the LA Unified School District. It's an extended conversation with him coming up.